This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Do you ever wonder what is really going on? What are the big stories the media leaves out while they fill the news with quirky headlines and fluff? All over the world, from pole to pole, the Earth and her species are going through big changes. The atmosphere is trapping heat into the oceans, air, and land, and that radiates out into everything living. This week, I'm going to cover five of those big stories with the help of one of the world's best risk watchers. He's author Robert Marston Fanny, and his launching pad is called Robert Scribbler's Blog. At the end, we'll squeeze in a few words about the new oil poverty creeping into our lives with a recent talk by former financial advisor and Oil Drum editor Nate Higgins. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. We know humans and all species are about to live through a huge change not seen on this planet for over a million years. We have no memory of this planetary shift, no history of it, no one has experienced it, and the first stages are already happening. As a science fiction author of Luthiel's Song and other works, Robert Marston Fanny has the imagination and ability to communicate well. As a former specialist on emerging threats for the prestigious military publisher Jane's Information Group, he's learned how to research and pry into things. All of that, plus a special something else that is hard to define, leads to one of the most stimulating climate change blogs on the net. It's called Robert Scribbler's Blog. Robert, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex. It's wonderful to be back and to be speaking with you again.
You know, as I read your blog every week, I think to myself, this is brilliant. Everybody needs to know about it. So we finally get to travel along some of the trails you made into science in the future. It's exciting in a frightening sort of way, isn't it, Robert?
I am quite frankly terrified, and that might be one of the reasons why I've been writing so much over the past few years.
Yeah, it stimulates me to keep making radio programs, too. Whether people get the message or not, we keep trying. Well, here's the catalog of recent blog posts I hope to cover or uncover with you. It's world-changing ocean currents, the cracks in the ice castle of Antarctica, drought and fires in South America, methane and blown craters in the Arctic, and the possible coming heat. That should keep us busy, don't you think?
There is quite a lot going on, and I think those are a good series of topics to cover, Alex.
Well, we haven't covered everything in your blog, of course, but it's a good place to start. And let's begin with your story on a possible big change in the ocean currents in the Atlantic. The movie The Day After Tomorrow crammed a long trend into just a few days, and there's been a few papers out, scientific papers, saying we should stop worrying, it ain't going to happen in our lifetimes. Why are you writing about it?
Well, there was a recent paper on the issue of a weakening in the overturning circulation in the North Atlantic, written by Ramsdorf. And this was based on some indications that we were getting signals from the sea surface temperature in the North Atlantic and from the atmospheric environment that was indicating a more rapid slowing down in the overturning in the North Atlantic. Now, this is a really, really, really big deal. And the movie The Day After Tomorrow dramatized the whole situation. It turned it into this rapid disaster movie that resulted in the dawn of a new ice age and massive storms hitting the entire northern hemisphere. And one, first off, we're not going to see a new ice age. That's, in a way, a complete misreading of the whole situation. But what we are likely to see with a slowdown in overturning in the North Atlantic is very serious consequences along a range of issues when it comes to ocean health, when it comes to rates of sea level rise, especially along the east coast of the U.S., weather anomalies along both the North Atlantic and for much of the northern hemisphere. Now, not of the same type that we saw in The Day After Tomorrow, but very serious weather anomalies nonetheless. Now, recently, we had reports from for example, the U.S. National Climate Assessment that was put out by the Obama administration, which is a very good paper. But in that paper, it stated that we would not see a shutdown in the North Atlantic overturning during this century. And in my opinion is that statements of this kind, where we make a definitive statement one way or the other saying this will happen, this won't happen, are probably not the best statements to be making at this time, because we don't have a high level of certainty, in my opinion, when it comes to what exactly will happen. Certainly we have very well-developed models. Certainly we have a very a good understanding of the way the climate system works. But what we don't understand is how sensitive the climate system is to the forcings that we are applying to it. And in my opinion, yes, there are some scientists that say, well, we're very certain that this probably won't happen, but even if we are very certain that this probably won't happen, we're still not 100% certain that it won't. In the case of North Atlantic overturning, even if the overturning weakens significantly, you have significant impacts. So even if it doesn't shut down this century, you still have problems on a scale beginning now, because what we see now is, if you're looking at ocean circulation in the North Atlantic, we see the Gulf Stream slowing down by about 10% as of the mid-2000s. We see an increase in signals in the ocean and the atmospheric signals now that show that that process is proceeding. For example, if you look at the sea surface temperature off the U.S. eastern seaboard for this winter, and right now, if you were to just look at the anomalies, the temperatures in the Gulf Stream are in the range of, at the highest point, between 9 and 11 degrees Celsius above average on any given day. Now, this is ocean surface temperature. Ocean surface temperature should not vary in that manner. Usually you'll see a variance of ocean surface temperature by about 1 to 2, maybe 3 degrees Celsius, right? So when you see a variation of 11 degrees in the Gulf Stream off the U.S. East Coast, that is off the charts. That is a severe variation. And the reason why that may be happening is that the warm waters that circulate up from the Gulf of Mexico in toward the North Atlantic are starting to pile up off the U.S. East Coast because the current is possibly slowing down. And this pileup of warm water is also resulting from potentially outflows, increasing outflows of fresh water from the Greenland glaciers. And that would also result in a cooling in the North Atlantic. And we've also seen that both at the sea surface and in the atmosphere. And what is chilling when you look at that is that this is the predicted change that we saw early on in some of the climate models, where you got this pool of cool air and cool water just to the south and east of Greenland, and all surrounding it is variable warming. So you have a region that is cooling, surrounded by the rest of the world, much of the rest of the world being the Arctic, the continents, the North American continent, for example, Europe, Asia, all relatively warming. And this one region near Greenland, especially in the North Atlantic, cooling as a result of, you know, what some call the iceberg cooling effect. Now, this is a very complex issue, because if you have a slowdown in ocean circulation in the North Atlantic, you get a number of knock-on effects. The first effect is that the amount of oxygen delivered to the deep ocean is reduced. And the result of that, the upshot of that, is a reduction in ocean health, in ocean productivity. So it's a rapid movement toward what is called a stratified ocean state. The other issue is that if you slow down the overturning in the North Atlantic and you start cooling that region, this cool region surrounded by a warming region, you have major atmospheric instability. So what you're talking about is seeing storms of variety that we haven't seen before in the North Atlantic, storms like what we saw in England last year, which got pummeled by a series of its worst storms on record since they started measuring wind and rain there. And for the U.S. East Coast, especially the Northeast for this year, where we saw severe winter weather in Boston, for example, 8 feet of snow over the course of a month in some regions. And the reason why you see that is because the primary driver for severe weather is temperature differential. So if you've got cold moving south from the pole over Greenland and becoming more entrenched over Greenland, if you've got cold or temperature departures, cold temperature departures increasing in the North Atlantic, right beside a region where in the more middle regions of the Atlantic you have rapid warming, then that is what I would like to call a screaming storm track. That's a region there where you have a high potential for very severe weather.
Right. I think this is what John Holdren was talking about when he said we should call it climate disruption as much as we would call it climate change. Let's move to the Southern Pole. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm talking with Robert Marston Fanny. Robert, tell us about some of the big news out of Antarctica.
Okay. Before I go on to Antarctica, there's the last point that I wanted to mention about slowing down the ocean circulation there. Is you end up getting a whiplash in the Gulf Stream, and what happens is the water backs up toward the U.S. East Coast, and that results in about a 1 to 3 foot sea level rise, depending on the level of slowing down of ocean circulation in the North Atlantic. So if you get a complete shutdown of the North Atlantic conveyor, you get about a 3 foot sea level rise, and that's not from any additional melt. That's just from water moving from one place to the next as a result of changes in currents. Now, you directed me on to Antarctica, and Antarctica is looking rather bad. We have multiple glaciers that are in destabilization. Thwaites, Pine Island Glacier, the Ross Ice Shelf is speeding up. The Larsen Sea Ice Shelf is threatening rapid destabilization. About 20 to 30% of that ice shelf is threatening to break off. There's a large crack running through the center of it. And the plug at the Totten Glacier in East Antarctica is encountering upwelling from a warm ocean current that is threatening a more rapid destabilization of that glacier. And that particular region could by itself contribute as much as 11.5 feet of sea level rise.
Wow. You know, it seems to me like just 5 years ago, people were telling me, yeah, the Arctic is a big problem. Don't worry about Antarctica. There's not much going on. It turns out we really just didn't have the science to know what was going on. I just watched a video where they're down there with probes measuring miles below the ice to see what the warm ocean currents are doing down below the Totten Glacier, for example. And it's pretty amazing. Now we find out things are really happening there. Warming is hurting that big continent.
Renault, for many years, have been warning about the issue of warm water upwelling. Many people did not listen to glaciologists that were talking about this issue. And also, we didn't have the same level of sensor coverage that we do now. We didn't have as many floats and probes checking on the ocean currents in that region. Now, as concern has risen on the issue of Antarctic melt, we're learning that Antarctica has a very weak underbelly in the sense that the glaciers there are vulnerable to below-surface warming, even though the surface itself has remained relatively cool and not warmed at the same rate, say, that we've seen in the Arctic. The bottom waters there have warmed rather precipitously. And the issue is you don't really even need much in the way of warming to start melting those glaciers. If you've got water that is 29 degrees Fahrenheit contacting those glaciers, then those glaciers won't really melt. That's at the point where it freezes. But if you've got water at 29.1 degrees Fahrenheit, that water contacts that glacier 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the heat content of water is very high, so even that small change can result in the loss of a lot of ice. And it appears that the way the weather systems, the storm systems around Antarctica themselves are intensifying, are driving both cold freshwater outflow from the continent, but also through an Ekman pumping process, a warm water upwelling near the base of these great glaciers, and that is really having a marked impact on glacial stability in that region.
Yeah, and I talked about the role of imagination. I interview scientists, Robert, about Antarctica, but they're often very, very cautious. In a way, science can only study the past and maybe barely capture a bit of the present. The future seems beyond it. What do these developments in Antarctica really mean?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily be so hard on the scientists. Science has placed upon it a high burden of proof. And so for a scientist looking at his career prospects, it doesn't make much sense to be making outrageous claims, especially in a field that is traditionally very conservative. But science affords us with a very real ability, faculty for prophecy, if we are willing to take the science itself and look at the trends and the implications of those trends. So if you look at Antarctica and you just look at the global sea level rise potential from melt in Antarctica, the continental glaciers in the rest of the world and in Greenland, right now we're looking at between 3 and 9 feet of sea level rise, in my opinion, this century, possibly more if things get well out of hand. The problem is that once you get these glaciers moving, they don't stop. If you start removing the basal regions and start speeding up these glaciers, you would have to have a very, very significant cooling to slow down and stop those glaciers. They want to slide out into the oceans. Gravity does most of the work once you start to melt the basal regions and lubricate the base and soften up those glaciers. So once you start locking in the kind of sea level rise that we're looking at this century, it tends to get locked in for multiple centuries in a similar manner. And the kind of warming that we are setting off this century alone, even if we respond very rapidly, historically has resulted in rather rapid rates of sea level rise. During a period of much slower warming, at the end of the last ice age, we saw as much as 14 feet of sea level rise in a single century at the maximum of the largest glacial outflows. And we have more than enough ice locked in those ice sheets right now, about 220, 240 feet of sea level rise, depending on if you look at thermal expansion in total, locked in. So that there's more than enough ice to generate severe outflows with comparable rates of warming. And the rates of warming that we are looking at are pretty much unprecedented, at least in the last 55 million years. We really have gotten ourselves out on a limb.
Imagine that the Romans and the Greeks had determined where we could build cities and where we could live now by their actions. That's what we've done. I think, you know, 1,000 years from now, we have determined just in a couple of generations where the coastlines, the new coastlines, will be.
Well, the problem is that the new coastlines are not stable. The new coastlines are moving. And the new coastlines won't be stable for hundreds of years.
If then. Yeah. So it's really the always changing nature of the sea that humans will have to come used to. We've always talked about sea level. There is no sea level.
Well, there's sea level, but what we're looking at is, I guess, maybe sea level delta. I like to talk about geophysical changes, and that's basically what we're looking at. We're looking at substantial geophysical changes that are recognizable and dangerous on a human timescale. And my personal opinion is that the scientists, the ones that have warned us are, in my opinion, being conscientious. But I don't honestly think that the public is taking the warning as seriously as it possibly could, because when you look at the scientists, the scientist does not want to tell you the bad news. It's not just like going to the doctor saying, okay, you've got cancer. When it comes to climate science or any of this cutting-edge science, the scientists don't want to tell you the bad news because there are severe consequences for them if they end up being wrong, very severe consequences. So what we are hearing from the science is, in my opinion, in many cases, the most cautious warning possible, with a few exceptions.
This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith, and I'm talking with Robert Marston Fanny, and we're looking at the big picture of climate change. And I'd like to move on to another continent here, and that's South America. You are one of the few bloggers who pays attention there, in my opinion. I found out about the drought in Sao Paulo from you, and you raised that alarm last fall about the lack of drinking water there, one of South America's biggest cities. How many people live there, and what is happening now?
Sao Paulo region, and that's just not including the Sao Paulo city proper, but the Sao Paulo region includes about 20 million people. And it has been undergoing severe drought. And this is a kind of unprecedented drought because this is one of the most water-rich regions of the world. You're talking about an area that has gotten used to massive amounts of rain due to the rainfall enhancing effects of the Amazon rainforest. Over the past couple of decades, clear cutting in the Amazon has combined with climate change to reduce the water rejuvenating potential of the rainforest. And so planners in the region of Sao Paulo have been caught a bit flat-footed because their water usage plans did not include the kinds of droughts that we are starting to see in that region. What we've seen in the Sao Paulo region is a severe drought, worse than at least 80 years. And that drought has been enough to enforce either official or unofficial water rationing since early last year. So we've had a year and a few months worth of water rationing for multiple millions of people in the Sao Paulo region. The water rationing didn't become official until early last year. Now, there has been a bit of an upsurge in precipitation over the past 2 months. So some of those reservoirs are starting to recover from what were near completely bone dry levels. But what we're looking at over the next dry season is the potential of some of the larger reservoirs bottoming out or coming again very close to bottom, depending on the situation. And we're looking more and more like El Nino in the Pacific this year, and that might have a negative impact on that region. It has, depending on the way El Nino plays out, it has traditionally had an impact.
So I've heard that sometimes in Sao Paulo the water has been cut off for hours or even days. Is that true?
Absolutely. You've had instances where water has been cut off for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, depending on, you know, the region. And you have people that are building cisterns to collect the water when the water is on or collect the water from rainfall, people who are drilling for water in essentially a rainforest region, drilling through urbanized city streets to get to water. You have had instances of water riots. Many of the reports on this, the particularities of what exactly is going on in the region are not very clear in the international press, but there were a number of reports issued by some water watch agencies late last year that indicated instances of water rioting.
My gosh. I mean, imagine if water was cut off to New Yorkers for a few hours or a few days, and yet we hardly hear about Sao Paulo. I'll bet you many of my listeners did not know this was even going on. Why is that?
I don't know. I for some reason, it doesn't seem like media is paying attention to what is going on in the world when it comes to climate. U.S. media is more focused on what's going on in the U.S., say, for example, with the California drought. And even that is not really covered to the extent that is warranted by a 1,200-year drought. So I don't know. The cliche is that if it bleeds, it leads. And what we have is bleeding all over the world when it comes to climate change, and it's really not being covered.
I think there's a blind spot towards South America in particular. We get less news from there than almost anywhere else. I actually hear a little bit more about Africa and Asia than I do about South America. And it's something that our media needs to address, and maybe we as a population need to address. Well, you've been writing also about the dry times and an extended fire season in Chile. You just reported on that in Robert Scribler's blog. What is happening in Chile?
We have a 100-year drought in Chile. Chile just popped up on the radar. I have a number of researchers that provide me with information, and there's been information off and on when it comes to Chile for some time, but we just recently had a spate of very bad wildfires in Chile. What's happening in Chile is much like California and other regions where people there rely on glacial water. The glaciers are retreating up the mountains, and so are the forested bands. So the lower levels of the mountains are becoming arid. The mid-levels continue to move up the mountain, and the glaciers are themselves dwindling away. this combination of aridification and loss of glacial water results in water shortages for a region that has had relatively rich farmland throughout its history. And so this is an ongoing systemic change to water in Chile. And most recently, over the past 2 years, we've seen a 100-year drought there. But it's a part of a longer ongoing trend. And Chile now is in a situation where they are building desalination plants to attempt to deal with a crisis that the scientists there are very vocal about and very cognizant about. They know that they know that climate change for them means more and more drought, more and more water shortages, more and more difficulty dealing with water.
And that is going to add to social stress as well.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. We're here with Robert Marston Fanny. He's a well-known science fiction author, but also an analyst and a blogger at Robert Scribbler's blog. Let's head to the other end of the Earth, the Arctic. There is a school of people who think methane eruptions from the Arctic seabed could wipe out the human species in this century. Are you part of that crowd, Robert?
Well, again, I do not like to put myself in the position of saying I think that something will happen with a certainty. My personal opinion is that there is a risk of Arctic methane eruption from a range of what we call a moderate scale eruption to a catastrophic scale eruption. I'm concerned about the Arctic because we are pushing the Arctic to warm extraordinarily rapidly. An example of some of the research that has come out recently in Climate Progress, Joe Rahm posted a report by a survey of 100 Arctic researchers stating that they believed that the Arctic was warming fast enough that the carbon feedback from the Arctic by the end of this century would equal between 10 and 35% of the current human emission. That would be between 1 and 3.5 gigatons of carbon coming from Arctic carbon feedback in the form of CO2 and methane. Now, the amount of methane that we could see as a part of that feedback would be a fraction of that total, probably in the range of 5 to 15%, maybe as high as 20 in the very worst case. But even so, even under that scenario, that is a bad outcome, because what ends up happening is, especially on the higher end, even if the world were to completely stop emitting carbon, if you have a 35% equivalent, or 3.5 gigaton per year carbon emission from the Arctic, that's enough to create a runaway climate change scenario. Even if human emissions are zero, at that point, human emissions need to be net negative by a significant amount in order to prevent serious consequences. Now, even a 10% net carbon emission, a 1 gigaton per year net carbon emission from the Arctic would be a bad outcome. So that being the low range should be cause for serious concern. I don't think people really understand the scale of things when we talk about carbon and methane emissions coming from the Arctic. We've seen some blowholes in the Arctic. We've seen some examples of what are potentially methane hydrate destabilizing at depth, and this would be relic hydrate at above the traditional stability level. The stability zone, so shallow hydrate that should be relatively rare according to what the science on methane hydrates indicates. But the size of these outbursts, when you're talking about tons of methane, you're talking about maybe 100 tons for some of the larger holes.
You're talking about these dozens of craters that have appeared in Russia, and the visions of them, the photos of spread out over the internet. Is that what you're talking about now?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. So if you're talking about an eruption on a gigaton scale, or even on a megaton scale, you're talking about an awfully large hole, or multiple awfully large holes. Some of the science has found very large holes in the bottom of the ocean in methane hydrate zones, many of them off of New Zealand, many of the largest ones. So some of these are miles across. So when you talk about catastrophic methane release, you're really talking about something that is quite extraordinary, that is quite outside the realm of, well, old science fiction writers used to call it an out-of-context problem. You're talking about severe geophysical change. And these blowholes that we are seeing now are small in comparison with what you would see in the case of a catastrophic methane release. Now, they're scary enough by themselves. The Russians are rather concerned. These blowholes are occurring in their natural gas production zones. They don't want one of these things popping up under a refinery or a pipeline or train or a building or anything like that. And in addition to that, we have some reports from Russian scientists of an unconfirmed 1 kilometer crater out in the Yamal region of Russia. We don't have any kind of detailed reports on this particular event. We don't know if it's subsidence or if it's related to methane hydrate instability or instability in gas systems beneath the surface. Part of the concern is that if you start to have small areas near the surface destabilize, some of the systems are interconnected, and so a small destabilization at first may possibly lead to larger destabilization, open up more pathways for heat and water to enter into deeper subsections of the hydrate system. My personal opinion is that we really don't know enough about what's going on up there. I have read a lot of reports where the scientists writing them are very certain that terrible catastrophic methane release could not happen. But some of these reports sound very similar to some of the reports I read many years ago saying that rapid Antarctic destabilization could not happen. So my opinion is, why don't we do more research and do our best to establish a range of possibilities so that we can get a handle on the risk. If we are just looking at, no, it's not going to happen, or yes, it is going to happen, then we really aren't creating a dialogue that narrows down the possibilities. If we look at a range and we actually start doing research and we start working together with some of these scientists that are doing the observations and some of the scientists that are doing the modeling, get some cross-pollination going on and not be so scared about talking about a rather scary subject, then we might actually have some progress on nailing down risk.
Yeah, it's still early days on that whole thing, and we hope we stay in these early days because, as you say, although it's an outlier, if we got a 50 gigaton release, as Natalia Shakova has warned could happen if a seabed collapsed or something, we'd get a big burst of warming, and we don't need that right now. Now, Robert, we talked earlier about the power of ocean currents. What is happening with warm waters entering the Arctic Ocean around Alaska via the Barents Sea?
Well, we have a lot of warm water invasion throughout the Arctic region, and most of it is coming in a lot like Antarctica at the basal region. There was a finger of warm water that moved in through the North Atlantic under the Arctic Ocean and through the Kara and Laptev Sea over the past couple of years. And a similar invasion has also occurred through the Bering Strait. Part of this is possibly due to, well, of course, ocean warming in general, but a mechanism that transports bottom waters. I call it the freshwater wedge. Usually if you get an expanding zone of freshwater at the surface, often from either increased glacial outflow or, in the case of the Arctic, you have increased water discharge from the rivers due to increasing precipitation in the region. You end up with a kind of pumping mechanism where the freshwater expands out from the ice cap region and pushes the warmer surface waters down, and you end up with a pumping process that draws that warmer water in from underneath. Now, well, with the Arctic, we have quite a bit of warm invasion, not just from basal waters, waters at depth, warm waters at depth, but we also have strong meridional atmospheric flows, especially in the region of the North Atlantic and in the Bering region near Alaska. And both of these meridional atmospheric flows are related to persistent high-pressure ridges in those regions, which are also likely or possibly related to atmospheric conditions which have been identified by Dr. Jennifer Francis, where you end up with a weakening of the jet stream due to polar amplification. So warming in the Arctic reduces temperature differential between the northern latitudes and the middle latitudes, and so you get very wavy jet stream. And what we have seen is that the ridging has tended to occur in the same regions, primarily along the northeastern Pacific, near Alaska, near the Bering, and also in a zone near Scandinavia and on north in between Greenland and Svalbard. Right now, if you were to look at a atmospheric or a surface level wind map, you would see a powerful south-north airflow coming from Europe and moving all the way up past the North Pole, pushing surface temperatures in that region near freezing for early April, and that's rather warm for this time of year. It's about 15 to 20 degrees Celsius above average. And right now we're in a period where we've seen near record low or record low sea ice extent for the entire Arctic for about a month running. So we're in not a really good spot when it comes to the launch of melt season.
You know, I'd like to move on to one of our final topics, I think, big topics. And I keep hearing new science that suggests we may be entering a new warming phase. Things have been delayed, they say, or hidden in the ocean, and now the heat is coming, this decade or the next. What have you heard about that, Robert Marston Fanny?
Recently, this past year, we've had a powerful shift to positive PDO in the Pacific, or what they call Pacific Decadal Oscillation. This December, we had record positive PDO values, which basically means that the Pacific Ocean surface has been in a record warm state for December. And the Pacific Ocean in general has, at the surface, been very warm. This tends to dump a lot of heat back into the atmosphere because it shuts down the Pacific Ocean's ability to uptake heat from the atmosphere. So the heat just generally tends to build up more and more. During periods when PDO has been positive, rates of atmospheric warming have tended to move much more rapidly. Now, this year and last year, we are also looking at an El Nino situation, an evolving El Nino situation, which is very slow to arise, but we are currently in an El Nino for the Central Pacific at this time. And right now, we are looking at a very strong Kelvin wave. A Kelvin wave is a subsurface ocean heat anomaly spike for the equatorial Pacific region, and is often an indicator of warming, future warming at the surface. So strong Kelvin wave is a leading indicator of future surface warming. And the Kelvin wave that we're looking at now, as of today, is as strong as the Kelvin wave we saw at the beginning of last year. And so we're looking into the mouth of likely a heightening El Nino situation in the Pacific. And what that means is that this year we will almost certainly see a near record warm year or a record warm year again. So we could see a back-to-back record warm year for 2015 and 2016. Now, if the Pacific Ocean has switched into the warm PDO phase, warm Pacific decadal oscillation, then we may be looking at a much more rapid rate of atmospheric warming over the next couple of decades. So what we've seen on average is about 0.15 C, 0.2 C per decade. We could be looking at a far more rapid pace of warming. Some of the scientists, including Michael Mann, have indicated that this pace of warming could be rather rapid.
Yes, we had Michael Mann on here. We talked a little bit about that, and he said, yes, there is evidence that warming will get hotter faster, and that's a very critical idea to grasp. Look, Robert, suppose we have a warming event of some kind in a single year or over 3 years. What do you imagine that would look like? What would we experience?
Well, if we had very rapid warming in a single year, you're looking at more intense droughts in certain regions, more intense rainfall events in certain regions, and you're also looking at weather instability in the sense that you're looking at potentially very rapid change from one condition, one persistent condition to another. So, for example, regions that have experienced persistent drought for a long period of time may switch very rapidly to a deluge kind of situation that lasts for a month or two and then results in record rainfall that has not been seen before. In addition, if you have rapid warming like that, especially in conjunction with El Nino, you can tend to see some situations that are similar to traditional El Nino, but then amplified by the additional warming. So if you're looking at India, India now is in a situation where the monsoonal moisture is increasingly in doubt even during normal years. So if you get a period of strong El Nino, rapid warming there, you could see an enhanced disruption of the Asian monsoon in that region. If you have very rapid warming, you can have areas of basically pools of extremely warm air that become isolated or cut off under very large high-pressure systems. We've seen instances similar to this, for example, in Europe or in Russia in recent years, but I think that we're at increased risk of seeing extraordinarily powerful heat dome systems in an age of rapid warming.
Yeah, in Russia, I think it was in 2010, they lost over a third of their wheat crop. They stopped exporting wheat, which added to world food prices, which added to world food instability and riots in some parts of the world. And then we had thousands die in Europe. So I think there are these tipping points, if you will, within societies where just a small amount of extra heat can show a weakness, whether it's in our agricultural system or the way we treat old people, as it turned out in Paris. That was the situation there. No air conditioning and older people not able to look after themselves. Well, I think, Robert, that some climate hawks would like to see a really visible heat wave. At least that might galvanize the world and its leaders into action. Could it be a good thing in a way?
I don't know. My personal opinion is there's enough going on now that people should already be concerned. People should already be galvanized. The primary problem that we have is, well, we talk about climate change denial, but I think that we can accept climate change denial not just as a political entity, but something that we are all to some degree or another guilty of. We don't want to see these things happening. And so there's a degree of just cultural resistance, regardless of political resistance. And I think we really need to be honest with ourselves and just start looking at the situation as truthfully as possible, developing a sense of urgency. In my opinion, a sense of dire urgency is necessary, and stop talking about the things that we can't do. We need to start talking about the things that we can do and start working on the issue of problem solving, of helping as many people as possible, of setting aside resources to deal with a problem, to develop a rapid transition away from carbon emissions of the kind that which are just catastrophic, and of potentially preparing for at least not the worst case scenario, but some of the worser potential events that we may be looking at coming down the road. There was a similar kind of malaise. I guess malaise might just be the best word. There was a similar kind of malaise prior to the events in the early 2000s, where the intelligence community was, well, yeah, we know there's a problem. We know there's probably going to be an issue. We had, say, for example, escalating bomb threats, things like that. But from a societal standpoint, there was this sense that, well, you know, we can't do anything about it. And then after the events, there was all this effort and galvanization. Well, the thing is, if we wait until the event with climate change before we galvanize, there's a very high risk that we won't have the resources necessary to deal with the problem. So we should really be very concerned. I grew up on the Atlantic Ocean, and when a storm was rolling in, we'd have these outliers. And if it was a very strong storm, you would get the sense of layering. So the first set of storms would hit, and they'd be pretty bad. But it wouldn't be so bad. You'd have some gusty winds, maybe some limbs break off the trees. But as you looked out into the ocean, you could just see these rings of increasing darkness. And that's what we're looking at with climate change. We're looking at layer upon layer upon layer of increasing difficulty. And unlike a storm, we can lessen the impact by what we do now. We probably won't avoid all the impacts, but certainly us rapidly reducing carbon emissions, even in the worst case scenario, will result in more wiggle room for us and our children in the future.
Now, as a recognized science fiction author, do you feel a pressing need to turn your science blogging back into a new work of fiction?
Well, I have been working very hard on the nonfiction aspect right now, but I have certainly in my spare time been continuing to write for the Luthiel Song series and continuing to inform my fiction with reality, with fact. And there are a number of projects that I would like to pursue, but for me, this right now is critical. It's a critical issue, and my opinion is that we need to start talking about climate change, and we need to start confronting it now. And hopefully I'll have the luxury to write more fantasy and science fiction in the future, but until I see more of a response from the mainstream press and more of a response from those who have both benefited the most from our society and have the most responsibility, then I'm not going to stop with my current focus.
Robert Scribler's blog has turned into kind of a quiet monster. It's become really popular with those in the know, kind of a thought leader thing. And I also appreciate the community of informed commenters that has built up around it. How does this blog fit into your life? Is it consuming a lot of time, and how can you afford to do it?
Well, it does. It consumes an awful lot of time. I tend to go in spurts where I will get very involved with the blog. I will write a number of articles, and I will do my best to respond to many of the commenters. I think that the dialogue itself is as important as the articles, because it gets people talking about the issue of climate change, hopefully problem solving, and at the very least dealing with some of their fears in a manner that makes them more manageable. It's, in my opinion, always the thing that is not talked about, the thing that is not looked at, that becomes overwhelming and it just grows as you run from it. But after those spurts, I tend to go back into research and write for future blogs. And the blogs have gotten relatively involved, requiring more and more research as I've gone. So I also do travel and other events relating to my fiction. So that's basically to keep my head above water. But right now I'd say the blog is certainly a priority.
As this radio show is for me, I can sympathize. I find myself spending more time on research than I thought possible. I feel like I need to educate myself enough to pass on what the guests have to offer, and usually that's more than I can offer, you know. So I'm wondering, is there anything else that you would like to say to our listeners as we wrap up here today?
Well, I would just say that do what you can to get involved. Even if you're just commenting and providing research or reposting articles on other sites, you're helping to inform others. I have a number of people who comment on my blog whom I consider to be expert commenters, people like Colorado Bob or Andy in San Diego, or Willie, who is a teacher and who often comments on places like Real Climate, and D.T. Lange, who is an expert on aerosol pollution, and so many more who have informed me just through their comments, even if they haven't necessarily had time to write blogs as often as I have. But it's very important, in my opinion, for us to have this discussion, to not just have the discussion of, oh, the climate change deniers are wrong and we're right and all that stuff. In fact, I think that discussion is counterproductive. What the discussion we need to have is, what is the problem we're facing? How can we develop problem-solving methodologies to deal with it? And how can we help each other? How can we support each other in what is obviously going to be a long, drawn-out, and rather difficult process?
It's a mission.
Absolutely.
Yeah. From Washington Grove, Maryland, we've been talking with science fiction author, emerging threat specialist, and climate blogger extraordinaire, Robert Marston Fanny. In literature, he's best known for the science fiction series called Luthiel's Song. Find out more about that at luthielsong.com or Luthiel's Song on Facebook. His previous Radio EcoShock interview titled, I Have a Confession to Make, continues to be downloaded by people all over the world. You can find links to all of that in my blog at ecoshock.info. And, of course, just Google Robert Scribbler's blog or go to robertscribblerwordpress.com to keep tuned into the stories most of the media failed to cover and that we've been talking about today. It's on my regular must-read list. Robert Fanny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alex. It's been fantastic.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In the little time we have left, I'm going to give you a taster of a simple but important talk by former Oil Drum editor, financial advisor to billionaires no less, and academic Nate Hagens. This is from my recordings at the launch of the World Watch Institute State of the World Report 2015 on April 13, 2015 in Washington, D.C.
So first up is Nathan John Hagens. Nate Hagens is a recovering hedge fund manager. Among many other things, he saw the light, left the belly of the beast, went and got his PhD at the University of Vermont, at the gun school, I suppose. Yeah. He's the former lead editor of the late lamented website, The Oil Drum, if any of you are familiar with that, on energy topics and everything related, which means just about everything. He's on the boards of the Post Carbon Institute and a variety of other groups, and his co-founder of the Bottleneck Foundation. He currently teaches human ecology at the University of Minnesota. Please welcome Nate Hagens.
So I used to manage money for billionaires. Basically, it was my job. And so I studied the human macroeconomy, which was I only cared about where stocks and bonds and commodities were going. And as Tom said, I left. And now I'm studying human macroecology, how the whole system of humans and our human ecosystem fits together. And I believe that unless we understand all major aspects of the system, we don't really have a coherent piece of view of what's going on. Today I'm going to talk about energy, but energy, money, the relationship between the two, and also I'm not going to talk about human behavior or the environment, but those are also very relevant pieces. So energy. The trophic period pyramid in nature is such that energy underpins everything. There is a heat loss when the sun hits the grasses. There's another one when the herbivores eat the grass. And then there's another one when the lion eats the herbivores, etc. But underpinning everything is energy up the trophic pyramid. The same thing happens in human systems. Our primary capital, our primary wealth, is natural ecosystems, forests, trees, rivers. In this picture, there's fossil fuels underpinning goods and services in the human system. We turn primary energy into secondary capital, like tractors and toasters and buildings and computers and services. And then we've got financial tertiary markers that represent all this stuff lower in the pyramid. So one thing that's not conventionally understood in economics textbooks is that we need energy as a precursor for every single thing that adds up to GDP in our economies. No matter how you might make a cup, you first need an energy precursor, whether it's made from coconut or ceramic or glass. You absolutely first need energy. So if you think about me, I'm about one-tenth of a horse. That's my horse, which is one horse. My vehicle, UTV, which is 45 horsepower, and my truck, which is 150 horsepower, all this is powered by the unbelievably energy-dense fuels in oil. So this amount of gasoline will power that truck a couple miles up and down snow, icy, hilly roads, and we take that for granted, the amazing power in this ancient sunlight. Okay, so standard economic textbooks treat energy as the same as any other commodity. You look at all the things on this graph, they're all cost about $60. sunglasses, well, $100 bill, tequila, a coffee maker, sushi, some boots. But in our economic system, they're all treated as equal in something called the Cobb-Douglas function, which shows that GDP is created from technology and labor. Energy is not involved. Energy is just outside of the system, and yet energy underpins everything that we do. One barrel of oil, and if you forget everything that I'm going to say in my talk, if you remember this, it's an important point. One barrel of oil has 5.7 million BTUs worth of energy. That translates to 1,750 kilowatt hours of human labor. That means Tom or I digging ditches or putting up roofing or carrying wheelbarrow loads of stuff, we can do 6/10 of 1 kilowatt hour in one day of work, a 9-hour day. So one barrel of oil substitutes 10 to 11 years of human labor. The average American salary is $45,000, so there's $500,000 of labor is substituted from one barrel. So if we look at the average number of the cost in the left column, the cost to generate 1 kilowatt hour of work for an average human is $260, okay? Versus gasoline at $2 a gallon is 5 cents. So this story of how our coworkers in our society are made from fossil carbon is largely one that is not recognized. So this amazing energy subsidy that we get from coal, oil, and natural gas, not talking about externalities yet, really is the story of higher wages, higher profits, lower priced stuff, and a dramatic increase in population the last couple hundred years.
This is where Nate Higgins explains, through the lens of energy, why real growth ended in the 1970s for most people in Western countries. Since then, as the cost of getting energy goes up, more poverty is created. We're all experiencing it. At this point, about 40% of Americans, for example, are pretty well broke, and 52% don't have enough savings to survive 3 months out of work. It's about the same in Canada and Britain. GDP may go up, but real wealth is declining, except for the favored few, and that's a fact that is hidden by ever-increasing debt. It's easy to understand with this speech. I invite you to listen to Nate Higgins' full 25-minute talk at the World Watch Institute. You can download it as a free MP3 file from my blog at ecoshock.info or listen to it directly on the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page. Meanwhile, we'll zip forward to Nate's quick summary of his presentation.
Summary. Energy is what we have to budget and spend. Money is just a marker for energy and primary capital. Fossil fuels have been so cheap that we replaced many tasks humans used to do and made enormous profits, wages, and cheap-priced goods. Number three, fossil extraction costs are going up, so wages, profits going down, and prices up. For most people, growth is already over. Everything we do will become more expensive over time if we cannot reduce the energy inputs faster than the extraction costs rise. And we actually really lack institutions and policies to even prepare for the possibility of an end to growth. And I had some additional questions, which I won't serve up, but maybe for the Q&A. But number three, I think all these things, these problems that we talk about, and World Watch has been so focused on, here are all the problems, what do we do? I don't think we can answer what do we do until we answer what do we aspire to? What do humans want, not only in the next 10 years, but the next 50, the next 500, the next 1,000? Until we address that question, we're just going to be kind of on a treadmill. Thank you.
That was just a small taste of a talk given by Nate Higgins at the World Watch Institute launch of their 2015 State of the World report. Download Nate's full 25-minute talk from my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info, or listen directly on the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page, also posted Wednesday. Get all the details with some video and the full World Watch report, if you need it, at worldwatch.org. Hey, we've used up all the time there is for this week. Thank you so much for listening to Radio EcoShock and for caring about our world.